got knocked over. In fact, I did get knocked over by some pretty music to tell us that it's time now on Books and Arts to review a couple of new Australian fantasy novels. There's King's Rising by Melbourne author C.S. Packat, who is, well, this is the highly anticipated final book in her very raunchy Captive Prince trilogy, and also Blood Innocence, a new book in the Sorcery Ascendant series by the Sydney writer Mitchell Hogan. And our regular fantasy reviewer is constitutional lawyer Professor George Williams from the University of New South Wales. Hi, George, welcome back. Hello, George, have we got you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, we've got you loud and clear. Now, I haven't spoken to you for ages. Where have you been?
Well, I've actually been based in the northeast of England for about 5 months, up there in Durham, and I must admit I escaped when it started to get very cold and very dark and fled back to the sunny shores of Sydney. But no, it was a great trip. It was a university sabbatical studying anti-terror laws, constitutional law, human rights, but it's time to get back to reality in Australia, I must admit.
So what do academics do when they talk about going on sabbatical? What does that involve?
Well, in my case, it means uplifting the whole family, going to a completely different part of the world, and kids going to school, and for me, having a position in Durham in a very nice office overlooking Durham Cathedral and immersing myself in the debates there about what their own academics are studying and what their governments are doing in areas like removing citizenship or how to respond to the Paris attacks. And sometimes you can only do those things when you're physically located there to get a real sense of what's going on.
Well, especially in Australia with the tyranny of distance, it's so important, isn't it, that we get on the ground and talk to people and get the feeling of how people are living and breathing these issues.
Well, it is. And what you find in these sort of areas is it's one thing to read about something on the page. It's another thing to be in the United Kingdom in the few days after those awful attacks in Paris to get a sense of how the community might respond, how they feel about those events, how governments respond. And in my area, that means just understanding, well, what laws become possible after those events. And the real lived experience is something that, sabbatical is about helping to understand.
It strikes me that so much of what you study in your academic work, the kind of study you're describing now, is about the clash of empires, the clash of great forces. And that's also what's happening in so much of the fantasy fiction that we read. You know, it's so often about the crown prince, you know, challenging for the throne, or a rival empire that's trying to overthrow the forces of civilization. Do you see parallels of that kind between your professional work and the fiction that you love so much?
Well, yes, I do. And I think I like the fantasy in part because the goodies almost always win. And you get some nice resolutions. Whereas in my own professional work, you're dealing with matters that play out over the course of years and decades and end often in messy outcomes where nobody may really win. And whereas there's often a clarity about fantasy that I enjoy that gives me quite a different perspective on things.
Yeah. So, George, you've been reading C.S. Packett's book, King's Rising, which is the third instalment in her Captive Prince trilogy. What's the setup for this series?
Well, you'd have to say that this is unlike any other fantasy book I've ever read. And when people normally think of fantasy, they think about strange creatures, elves, orcs, Lord of the Rings. They perhaps think about magic users and all sorts of fantastic conceits there, or maybe an entirely different world, a different planet. But in many ways, much of this book is well known. It's set in what people might see as an ancient Greek, Roman, French setting, something along those lines, but easily recognisable with many of the normal cultural norms we understand. But the big difference here, the fantastic element, comes to one key difference, and that is that here, in this particular world, there is such a stigma attached to having children out of wedlock that men engage in homosexual sex with men rather than having illicit liaisons with women. And that just reshapes everything in this world. And in doing so, you have a book where homosexual gay behaviour is in fact the norm as opposed to the difference. And that means that really it sets itself apart from almost any fantasy book out there.
So the two chaps who are at the centre of this homoerotic story are Damios, or Damianos, I suppose it is, also known as Damon and Laurent. Who are they?
Well, on the one hand, you've got Damon, who is the buff, good-looking, somewhat naive, easily likable character. He's a prince of his own realm who's been sent as a slave by his half-brother to another realm. and he's been sent as a slave essentially to punish him, to put him aside from the throne so his illegitimate brother that can take over power. And when he gets there, he becomes this pet, this slave to Laurent, who in this other world is lithe, blonde, somewhat prickly but refined and super intelligent, and the two of them have an immediate reason to hate each other. Damon killed Laurent's brother, and their nations have been at war for a long time. And the story is really about how this relationship beginning in slavery unpicks itself, and this passion that emerges between these two that really flowers and blossoms into something quite remarkable.
So it is a kind of Romeo and Juliet story in one way.
Well, really Romeo and Romeo, you'd have to say.
Yes, but, yeah, that's right, yeah. Now, what's all this about descriptions of hair?
Well, it's a book that, again, this is a key difference. It's a book that doesn't focus so much on the normal things you expect in fantasy, big action sequences or descriptions of fantastic creatures. But it's a very intimate, intense look at this relationship between these two people and how that develops over time. And what you have is a lot of very sensual descriptions of their bodies, their hair, a lot of the colour around them. There's a lot of symbolic language used in the book. And what it does is it really deepens and adds a complexity to this relationship, which is quite striking. Because in many ways, I came to this thinking, this just sounds, apart from the homoerotic element, you know, very standard stuff. But in fact, the writing is quite pristine. It's quite remarkably written. And in doing so, it achieves a level of characterisation that just is very atypical for fantasy books.
So it's not just a premise for telling a sexy story.
Oh, I think it's a bit of that,
right?
Without a doubt. But no, it is much more of that. This is.
I realised the way I asked that question implied there was something wrong with a book that's premise was simply to tell a sexy story. But bring them on. I mean...
Well, of course, you've got Game of Thrones and other fantasy books out there which have been unabashed in sex, violence, all sorts of things. But this, again, is a step away from that, in that the erotic story at the centre of this book really is the driving force of this novel. The passion between these two, which builds and builds and builds, is something that, in many ways, the rest of the narrative is there to support that, as opposed to sex scenes often being somewhat gratuitous and off to one side. And, you know, that, again, is very different for these type of books, which does make it very much an adult book. This is not for kids, that's for sure, because it's explicit, graphic, and there's even rape as entertainment in some parts of it, which is very off-putting. But it's done in a way which I'm sure many people reread again and again. It's that type of book.
So you didn't feel yourself having ethical qualms about the way in which the story was using these kind of elements for entertainment?
Well, I questioned myself, yes, at various points about exactly that. And, I mean, this premise of submission and slavery, which comes throughout the book, and also, you know, these very graphic, violent sex scenes, which just isn't my thing at all. And you know, the homoerotic is not something that I've really experienced in fantasy in this way. But I think the skill of the writer really meant that in the end, I found this one of the most compelling books I've read in the last couple of years. And I found myself just wanting to continue reading. And I really just couldn't put it down because all of these elements coming together produces something which is fantastic and different. And, you know, plausible in a way that really does suspend your disbelief and just force you to want to find out what's going to happen next between these two characters.
What do we know about the author, C.S. Packett, which is P-A-C-A-T?
Well, not much, because it's not her real name. And there's been a lot of media interviews with her over the last couple of years. But she's certainly, you know, not very well known publicly, even though her writing now has got a big international following. She's from Melbourne. I mean, she describes herself in one of her interviews as being bisexual herself, but obviously for a lot of these quite detailed sex scenes, she'd have no personal experience. So she had to talk to some of her gay male friends to get the details right. And she's obviously done her research in doing that. We also know that she had a lot of trouble getting this book published, despite what has been a big success. And it was actually self-published and then just took off on the internet. And she's a bit like Hugh Howey or some of the other self-published successes of recent years, that once people got a grip on this, they demanded more and it then got picked up by a major publisher.
Do you have any sense why she's using a pen name?
Look, no, I don't. I haven't seen her explain why that is. I mean, it might be the nature of the content, perhaps. It might be that this was first self-published on the internet, and the content and the nature of the internet maybe means you don't want to reveal too much about
yourself. I mean, she's not hiding who she is. There's a photo of her on her website, so you can...
No, she's not. And she's got her own persona out there, despite the raunchy, graphic nature of these books. She comes across in some of the photos as very straight-laced, and you can see there that she's... you know, she's got an eye herself to how she wants to present herself in writing this material, and I think we'll see a lot of her in the future.
This is Books and Arts on RN, and we're reviewing fantasy fiction with Professor George Williams. So that one is King's Rising by C.S. Packett. Now, the next one we're going to look at very quickly is Mitchell Hogan's Blood of Innocence. So who's Mitchell Hogan? I haven't heard of Mitchell Hogan.
Well, he's a new Sydney-based author on the fantasy scene, and he's someone who, again, started with self-publishing and had his books achieve great success before they were picked up by a commercial publisher. The first of his books in this series, The Crucible of Souls, won the Aurealis Award in 2013, and that was a really assured, strong debut in the fantasy scene. And what we've now got is the second book in the series, Blood of Innocence. What he's writing here is, in many ways, stock standard fantasy. It's old school. It's not a lot of violence. Certainly no sex there. It's a book also that doesn't have dark themes that you find in Game of Thrones and many other books. But what it is a really strong entry by a new author into fantasy books for a more accessible audience, from young adult through to adults themselves.
So what's it about, this one?
Well, this is about a coming-of-age story, and again, we have many of these, and here we have a person called Caldan who's orphaned, parents died in mysterious and bloody circumstances, who's got to come to terms with his own powers, his own place in the world. And in the first book, we really had his origin stories. He comes to understand a bit about who he is. The second book, I must say, I didn't enjoy quite as much. It's more a travel book. It's more complex. Caldan himself, the character, is less assured and I think more naive and makes some really misguided decisions. And it's a bit of a frustrating book in that way. But it's still well written and it's well set up, I hope, for what's going to be a really strong third and final entry in the series.
Yeah, I've read a couple of ho-hum reviews of this one on Goodreads, which felt that it was solid and but a bit generic, and that perhaps the hero was a bit thick.
Well, I think that's right. And in the first book, he's hyper-intelligent. And the second book, you find yourself saying, what are you doing? I mean, why are you making those decisions? And the first book was a real standout. I mean, that again had that compelling quality you want in fantasy books that immerses you quickly and drives you along. The second book was a bit slower and wasn't of the same quality, I think, as we've seen recently. But the pieces are there, I think, and it's the nature of fantasy books. I mean, I was hooked with the first book. I'm invested in the series and I'll read the third, and I've got high hopes that we see a book that's just as good as where he started.
Just briefly, these are both Australian writers. Am I right in feeling that Australian fantasy writers are starting to make a mark?
Look, I think they are, and it's a long time ago now where you had to look at Sarah Douglas and a few of the other writers to realise there really weren't many on the scene. We've got two here today, two new emerging writers. We also see Trudy Canavan and others achieving great international success. In fact, when I was in London, it was a great pleasure to see Trudy's books featured in a number of London bookstores in their window displays. And you really know that the Australian fantasy scene is alive and vibrant when you've got that sort of exposure in London.
Well, thanks, George, for joining us. Is it O Week at your university this week?
Very soon. In a week,
time.
And the hordes will arrive.
Yes. But it makes you feel young, George. You look out at all those young, hopeful faces.
Or old, because you realise how long they look younger each year. One of the two.
Jeez. A divided man. Professor George Williams, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of New South Wales, and our resident reviewer of fantasy fiction. So those books, again, are King's Rising by C.S. Packett. That one's published by Penguin. And Blood of Innocence by Mitchell Hogan, brought to us by HarperCollins. And that concludes proceedings for today. Now, don't forget African Book Club. That's our book club right through the year. So I wonder whether you've planned your reading yet. If you pop along to our website on the right-hand side of the page, there's a picture there for the African Book Club. And if you click on that, the 11 titles that we're reading this year are right there. And look, if your book club, your own book club, has decided to read one or two of these, do let us know, because perhaps we could somehow incorporate you in our discussion. So it's Half of a Yellow Sun's the first one right there on the list. It won the Orange Prize for Women's Fiction. So it's a good one. Now, tomorrow you'll meet two leading makers of contemporary dance, Sweden's Alexander Ekman and Raphael Bonicella, who's the head of the Sydney Dance Company. And we'll talk about why contemporary dance sometimes seems to be a bit esoteric, as though it's not quite for you, as if they're just dancing for themselves. And how this might be changing. Perhaps there is a new wind blowing through the corridors of contemporary dance. The news is next, and then it's Earshot, and today a lovely title, The Singing Planet, will journey into the world of composer Edward Cowie, who hears nature as music. It promises to be a very magical experience. That's Earshot, straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Toodaloo.